And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, finishing up a month locked in the house. It's watching the news. It's scary time. And I've been watching a lot of videos from some of the Asian sources that, in fact, coronavirus was created in a laboratory for biological warfare. And it does fit with what I know about the Chinese plans for world domination. One of their senior generals said that in a battle between the U.S. and China militaries, China's at a disadvantage. So they needed to find another way for what they call total war, and one of those ways, of course, is biological warfare. And certainly the way this coronavirus is moving, it defies any logic unless it is a biological I forget what the term is. Basically, the same type of disease as AIDS. A retrovirus, I'm sorry. And the well, that's interesting. My system just stopped when I said that. There has been a lot of discussion about the internet, big brothers, if you will, trying to monitor and keep it all politically correct. And Google and Facebook have danced to the tune played by the Chinese leaders, so nothing would surprise me. We've been talking about secret societies, and yesterday we talked about the Masons and the Knights Templar. Well, today we're going to talk about the Priory de Sion. Now, this is one that's hadn't been a lot discussed about it. But basically, if all families have secrets, then some secrets are more common than others. And surely among the most familiar family secrets is a clandestine marriage. Or maybe no marriage at all that produces a child whose existence is never acknowledged. And that's the basis of the Priory de Sion, whose members are legion, whose adherents are fanatic, and whose history, according to some serious research, is neither mundane or absurd. In fact, in my family, I've been doing the family history since I was 16 years old. And the things I have discovered makes you wonder what other secrets are being hidden out there. But it does explain while I have some cousins who like to sit on the front porch and play the banjo. Now, mind you, the tale about the Priory de Sion has its understandable appeal. Who could resist a story involving a fake death, a reformed prostitute, and a bloodline traced through individuals as eminent and gifted as Leonardo da Vinci, Sir Isaac Newton, Claude Debussy, Jules Verne, Victor Hugo, and, even though I don't want to blow my own horn, my own line. Toss in the Templars, the Nazis, a vast hidden treasure, and the promise of retrieving an artifact of Christ's crucifixion. We're talking about the Holy Grail. And the epic grows more enticing than anything a Hollywood scriptwriter could create. For this reason alone, the Priory de Sion boasts thousands of adherents who allege proof of his existence and contend it's influenced world events for 2,000 years. Well, in spite of many celebrated names associated with the Priory, reality suggests the tale revolves around three primary characters. A poor parish priest who needed an explanation for his accumulation of personal wealth. An anti-Semitic Freemason searching for a way to fulfill his wartime dreams. And a charming medieval princess. Not to mention Jesus Christ and his alleged wife and child. Now, the basis for this tale has more variations than the works of Mozart. But according to the story, despite certainty among Christians, Mary Magdalene was no Jerusalem strumpet, but a middle-class Jewish wife of Jesus. Their union either never divulged or conducted in a manner described today as common law. But I would point out he was referred to as a rabbi, and rabbis traditionally are married. Depending on the source, Christ's crucifixion was faked, and he and his child fled Jerusalem to escape death. Or Mary Magdalene escaped alone from Palestine following Christ's actual death. Either way, she arrived on the Mediterranean coast of France, suggesting she traveled by boat and she was, in fact, pregnant. Moreover, her pregnancy resulted in the birth of a healthy baby whose offspring, traced through two millennia of history, have influenced world development to an enormous degree, even while their existence has been hidden from the general populace. According to the proponents of the existence of the Priority Sion, the term Holy Grail refers not to a chalice or some other utensil used at the Last Supper, but to the bloodline traced from Christ through his descendants. The Holy Grail is also translated as Sangreal, which is royal blood. It's difficult to imagine a story more capable of tilting virtually every tenet of Christianity into a cocked hat than the suggestion that Mary Magdalene gave birth to a descendant of God through Christ. And that premise alone has spawned dozens of explanations for historical events, including those for which no explanation otherwise be deemed necessary. The creation and initial success of the Templars, for example, is traced by some to the French-based line of Christ's descendants. Proponents of this theory point to France as the acknowledged root of the Templar strength and the fact that their destruction was organized by a French monarch, who perhaps had learned the truth of their blood heritage. In partnership with a newly elected pope, aware of the dangers to the church if the truth were revealed, the French king grew determined to eliminate the Templars. Motivated not by fear of the Templars' power and his avarice for their wealth, but by the need to purify Christianity. Indeed, a lengthy list of descendants of Jesus can be found in secret dossiers written on ancient parchment and placed in the care of the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. And many names on that list are obscure. Some are recognized by scholars for being associated with the occult, especially during medieval times. A few qualify as first-rank historical celebrities: Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, Victor Hugo, Claude Debussy, Jean Cocteau, and, of course, Leonardo da Vinci. Well, why maintain records of such a distinctive lineage and keep it secret for 20 centuries, only to make it public at the end of the second millennium? Maybe to restore the dynasty established by Mary Magdalene, a bloodline that extends not only to the throne of France, but to the thrones of other European nations, creating an international cabal tied by common lineage and devoted to controlling world events. This family line, known as the Merovingian dynasty, took control of France about AD 475, filling the power gap created when the Roman Empire collapsed and extending its influence across history ever since. Now, Merovingian is derived from Merovius, father of Childeric I, who became the first non-Roman ruler of Gaul, the region now known as France. Merovius, so the legend goes, could trace his ancestry back through Joseph of Arimathea to Christ. Excuse me. Or maybe he couldn't. While some monastic records identify Merovius in this manner, the historian Priscus claims he was sired by a mysterious sea creature, explaining the source of his esoteric knowledge and skills in the occult. The relationship between it with a sea creature is shown as evidence that A, Mary Magdalene stepped out of a sailing vessel onto the shores of France where she gave birth to the Son of Jesus, and B, an effort has been made to obscure this same historical fact by immersing it in fable, or C, an attempt has been made in the opposite direction, identifying Merovius' ancestor with Christ because the fish is a symbol of Christianity. Or there's also a D, that some folks have put forth, and that's the fact that the Merovingians were descendants of extraterrestrial beings who bred with chosen Israelites and creating a true super race. You pays your nickel, you takes your chance. The tale remains murky till 671, when the Merovingian prince Dagobert II married Giselle de Rosés, the daughter of the Count of Rosés, the niece of the Visigoth High King, thus uniting two powerful forces that had long struggled against each other for control of France. Now, Dagobert appears to be an erudite man for his time. Educated in an Irish monastery, he married Matilda of York, a Celtic princess, and settled in England, where he became friends with St. Wilfrid, the Bishop of York. Upon the death of Matilda, the bishop guided him into a marriage with Giselle. Based on a description of Giselle's a ravishing beauty, skilled in the arts, and educated beyond the levels of women of her time, it sounds like a marriage literally made in heaven. Or at least in Languedoc, the area of France bordering the Mediterranean between Marseille and the Spanish border. Here, there's an old Visigoth chapel dedicated to Mary Magdalene near the city of Rueda, and that's where they were wed. Thanks to several geographical advantages, Rueda boasted a population at the time of more than 30,000 people. Situated at the intersection of roads extending across adjoining valleys with several freshwater springs nearby, the town dated back to pre-Roman times. It was a natural location for celebrating in the union of two powerful families. Well, things went reasonably well at first, especially for a Dark Ages warrior. Dagobert managed to wrest what's now modern-day France away from the clutches of three brothers who'd claimed the land after the death of their father, and Dagobert gave him a son and an heir, an important achievement in those times. And Dagobert began to consolidate his power, which angered both the church and his old friend Wilfrid. Like most rulers of his time, Dagobert created enemies, so many that few of his subjects were surprised when he was murdered while on a hunting expedition. And it was only through luck, perception, or maybe divine intervention that Giselle and their son Sigisbert, managed, accompanied by a small group of faithful knights, managed to escape. From that point on, Sigisbert and his descendants kept their lineage a secret from others, even while recording it among themselves so that members could recognize the holiness of their ancestry and use it to achieve greatness of one kind or another. Soon after, Rueda began a long decline from its status as a major center. After being devastated during battles with Spain, its inhabitants suffered terribly during the plague years. Repeated sacking and burning by Catalan bandits persuaded the remaining residents to abandon the city entirely. Most fled inland, while hardly few remained, rebuilding their community as a village named Rennes-la-Château. Meanwhile, the monastic order is founded in Jerusalem, known as Our Lady of Mount Zion. The order later transferred its headquarters to St. Leonard d'Acre in Palestine, and later still relocated to Sicily. Operated there for a long time before it being absorbed by the Jesuits in 1617. Everything we know about it appears to verify that this priority of Zion functioned like dozens of other facilities of its time. As a center for meditation and salvation, it interacted with the community around it, playing the usual feudal medieval role of social hub, inspirational retreat, and cultural resource. Nothing suggests it seethed with conspirators, harbored Templars plotting revenge against the church, and served as a genealogical resource for Latter-day Merovingians. The only role in history has been to provide a name for a society that claims 2,000 years of threatened yet influential existence. Well, the next chapter of this bizarre tale begins in 1885 when a Catholic priest named François Béringer Saunier is dispatched to the parish surrounding the village of Rennes-la-Château. Over 1,000 years had passed since the wedding of Dagobert and Giselle that bound the Visigoth kingdom and the Merovingian bloodline. The old strategic city that had been the site of their marriage was now a backwater village housing maybe 200 people. Now, Saunier is an interesting historical figure, made more interesting by his involvement in perhaps the most compelling secret society legend of our time. He was well-educated and ambitious, but the handsome Saunier could only have been disappointed, if not crushed, upon arriving at his new posting. Located about 40 kilometers from Carcassonne in the shadows of the Pyrenees, Rennes-la-Château might very well have been on the moon as far as a priest with high aspirations was concerned. At 33 years of age, Saunier saw this assignment as the end of the road, if not the end of his dreams. And to make things worse, Saunier inherited not a parish church, but what was actually a pitiful ruin. Much of the chapel roof was missing, permitting rain to pour directly onto the altar. The windows were covered not with stained glass, but with rough boards. The presbytery was virtually uninhabitable. No housekeeper had been assigned to him, and his monthly salary of 75 francs was barely enough to buy bread for his own table. The only thing more surprising than the state of Saunier's church was the fact that he decided to remain. At least part of this decision may have been inspired by carnal rather than ecclesiastical notions. While priests weren't permitted to recruit women as housekeepers, the search suggested that 30 years or more separate their ages, indicating that Saunier's live-in housekeeper should be in her 60s. But Saunier went the other way with the age compass, and soon 16-year-old Marie Dinernaud began sharing the rundown presbytery with him. And over time, it became acceptable the couple shared the same bed. A situation that the community and Saunier's superior, the lenient and amiable Bishop of Carcassonne, appeared to have tolerated. Marie Dinernaud may have been attracted to the priest for a reason other than his handsome appearance. Maybe it was his passionate nature, which he demonstrated within a few months arriving at his new posting. During the state elections held in October of 1885, Father Saunier became a rapid opponent of the ruling Republican Party, haranguing and practically ordering his parishioners to vote against it. Well, his scolding sermons made little difference to the outcome. The Republicans won, and when stories of Saunier's rabid sermons against him became known, they pressed for revenge, and they got it. Well, as punishment for his political indiscretion, his salary was suspended. He appealed to the bishop, who, having forgiven the priest unapproved living arrangements with his nubile housekeeper, extended his charity by appointing Saunier to a professor's post at the nearby Petit Seminaire de Narbonne, where the fiery priest stalked the halls and classrooms for 6 months till his suspension was lifted. Well, church leaders thought they had slapped him down. They were very much mistaken. In fact, Saunier returned to the village in his dilapidated structures, this time with the backing of a wealthy supporter and plans to improve the fortunes of his parish and of himself. Maybe in admiration for his political stand, which may have coincided with her own, the influential Countess of Chambord bestowed 3,000 francs on Saunier upon his return to his parish. Now, that figure is significant because Saunier had reportedly obtained an estimate of 2,800 francs to make repairs to the church. And to his credit, he appears to have dedicated all of the countess's donation toward rebuilding and restoring the church. Well, somewhere along the way, Saunier became fascinated by the legend surrounding his church's supposed historical significance. Few sources claim the tale of the church was already well known among the local citizens. Others say no one was aware of its historical importance till the restoration work was well advanced. And as things turned out, neither explanation is significant. Now, Saunier's church, dedicated to Mary Magdalene, had been constructed on the site of the marriage between Dagobert II and Gisèle de Rezés. According to the story, and Saunier made an amazing discovery while assisting in its reconstruction. Now, a heavy stone that has served as an altar in the original edifice was mounted on four pillars. Saunier himself moved the slab to discover one of the pillars was hollow. And from within that space, he gently pulled out four ancient parchments, making a point to keep them hidden from the eyes of the others working around him. Now, two of the parchments traced a genealogical family line, while the other two were written in a mysterious code that took experts in Paris some time to decipher. And when they did, the words were electrifying. To King Dagobert II, to Sion belongs this treasure, and he's dead there. Well, that one word got a lot of attention. Treasure? What treasure? The answer appeared when a second stone slab was unearthed. Something was concealed behind it, and something only Father Saunier saw. One glance told him his dreams of being assigned to Bordeaux or Paris or even Rome itself were nothing compared with the wealth that lay before him. Soon Saunier and two trusted helpers were busy as gophers, unearthing sites all around the church and on the outskirts of the village. Now, Sonier may have had to beg for funds to repair his old church in the beginning, but from this point forward, the building activity at Sonier's church was intense and extravagant enough to generate envy in every prelate from the bishop parish on down. This little church was rebuilt to magnificence, decorated with paintings and sculptures purchased by Sonier on expeditions to Paris. Now, some were traditional, like the Shepherds of Arcadia, a painting that illustrated a group of people gathered around a sarcophagus in a landscape eerily similar to René La Chateau. Others were obscure, in both style and meaning, including a statue near the church entrance that bore the Latin inscription, "This place is terrible." Now, the priest accumulated enough riches to purchase more than artifacts for his church. He bought several acres of land adjacent to the property began the construction of the Tower of Magdala in honor of Mary Magdalene, and a multi-room mansion named Villa Bethania for himself and Marie. Now, the expenditure to do this construction was enormous. 40,000 francs for the tower, 90,000 francs for the mansion, and 20,000 francs for an adjoining garden. And in addition, or in total, Sonier spent an estimated 200,000 francs paid out by a man who a few years earlier had received a pitiful monthly salary of 75 francs. In contemporary terms, 200,000 francs in 1900 would be equal almost 7 million francs, or about 1.25 million U.S. dollars today. Now, others estimate the value of Sonier's expenses ranged up to 250 million francs, or about $50 million, a figure that really strains the credulity. But certainly, all things are possible. Now, Sonier may have been dispatched to a backwater located in an uninspiring corner of France, but he was living like a combination of Vatican cardinal and Eastern potentate, a man whose every desire, be it material, spiritual, cultural, and carnal, appeared satisfied thanks to an apparently endless source of funds. He fed special biscuits to his flock of ducks to produce a milder flavor when they were roasted, had a well-stocked wine cellar, and had 70 liters of rum brought in every month from Jamaica. In June of 1891, Sonier staged a procession through the village to display a newly acquired statue of the Virgin of Lourdes, which he installed on a pillar in the elegant new church gardens. Following year, he added a new confessional and pulpit and mysteriously designed Stations of the Cross set in an unusual circular pattern that was believed to represent a coded message. The water stoop soon boasted an elaborate guardian devil, a commissioned statue of Mary Magdalene, and numerous other items that elevated his tiny church far above the expected level of taste and culture in such an otherwise insipid community. Well, the ambitious priest began decorating more than his beloved church. The villagers delighted in his plans to construct a grotto near a life-size image of Christ on the cross in the town square. And Marie Thénardaud took equal delight in wearing the latest Paris fashions in her strolls through the marketplace. Sometimes carrying a purse containing deeds to property Sonier had bought in her name. Well, local citizens were curious about the source of Sonier's riches, but not especially so. After all, he's providing employment for local artisans and adding a measure of distinction that the community had sorely been lacking. Besides, their interest was sufficiently satisfied with a tale that explained things reasonably while appealing to their somewhat rebellious nature. They believed he had unearthed something more valuable than gold and jewels during his explanation. Treasure Dagobert, the identity of the buried man, remember the statement, "He's dead there," was not the long-deceased Merovingian king himself, but the body of Christ, its location pinpointed by a coded parchment hidden in the pillar beneath the altar. Well, consider how important this discovery was. The existence of Christ's body in an insignificant French village would destroy every tenet of Christianity, scatter every foundation of its faith, and demolish every institution from the Vatican on down. Either Christ hadn't died on the cross, or he had not risen from the dead and had been elevated to heaven 3 days later. Each theological principle of Christianity would have to be rethought, rewritten, or discarded entirely, along with 2,000 years of piety and sacrifice. So what was Sonier to do? A deeply religious man might have kept the secret forever, clinging to the faith he had lived by and refusing to shatter the spirituality of millions. A rationalist would have made his discovery public, challenging old ideologies and assisting in replacing them and the faith they represented with a new order. Well, Saunier was neither one of these. He was a materialist who, quietly disclosing his discovery to a small group of selected church leaders, promised to conceal the facts in exchange for a generous stipend paid by the church while they plotted their next move. In effect, Christianity was being blackmailed by an obscure French priest living openly with his young housekeeper mistress. And if this was the case, the church's ultimate response after several years of meeting his demands might be first to discredit him and then slap him down and be done with it. Which is what happened, but not before various mysterious events occurred, the kind that set small-town tongues wagging and conspiracy fans salivating. Well, the process began dramatically with the strange deaths of two local church officials. On the eve of All Saints' Day in 1897, Abbé Gillis, a reclusive priest in a nearby village of Costossa, was found brutally murdered in the kitchen of his presbytery. Beaten with a pair of fire tongs and an axe, the priest had been reverently positioned on the floor with his hands neatly placed on his chest. Now, while the residence had been ransacked, robbery was certainly not the motive because 800 francs were found in an easily accessible drawer. And interestingly enough, the murder was never solved. 5 years later, the placid Billard of Casson was also murdered. Now, Billard, who not only failed to question Saunier regarding his wealth and extravagant lifestyle, but appears to have encouraged it, suffered a fate as brutal as Abbé Gillet's, and his murder was also unsolved. Bishop Billard's successor, Abbé Le Bessageur, was not as forgiving to Saunier as Billard had been, especially after delving into the priest's background. Accusing Saunier of unspecified outrageous acts, the new bishop demanded explanations for Saunier's actions and an audit of the parish income and expenses, demand Saunier ignored before attempting to placate his superior with faked and incomplete records. By 1909, the bishop had enough. He ordered Saunier to leave his post at Lanlay-le-Château. When Saunier refused, he was promptly defrocked. For 8 years, the disgraced priest remained in the village, cared for by the faithful Marie Denernaud, to whom he willed all his earthly possessions when he died in 1917. His estate consisted of a few books and a handful of worthless trinkets, but Marie was assured of a reasonably comfortable existence because Saunier had transferred Villa Bethania to her. She survived for the next 30 years by renting rooms within the mansion, finally passing ownership of the property her lover priest had acquired in her name to a local businessman in exchange for a lifetime annuity. This income source supported her for the rest of her uneventful life until she died in January 1953. The man who bought the land and provided the annuity was Noel Corbeau, a local entrepreneur. Now, through the period between the two world wars, while Marie Denernaud lived quietly with her memories and secrets, France was jostled by two competing political factions. Royalists, who supported a return to a monarchist government, enjoyed open support from the Catholic Church, and the Republicans, who favored democratically elected governments. Many leaders of the Republican movement were Masons, who had dominated French politics since the 1880s. The conflict remained relatively benign until France encountered the upheaval of the late 1920s and brought Hitler into power. Assuming many of the postures that characterized the Nazi group, groups composing the French far right grew more racist. Along with a wave of anti-Semitism sweeping Europe, French right-wing extremists added Masons to their list of likely traitors and subversives. And given the turmoil of Europe and the global economic crisis produced by the Great Depression, scapegoats were found everywhere and coalitions congealed whenever a common enemy was identified. Extreme anarchists joined forces, presenting themselves as knightly orders assigned to redeem a lost society now dominated by Jews and Masons. The election of Leon Blum, a Jew as the country's first socialist prime minister, drove monarchists and the far right into a coalition that paved the way for the Vichy regime and France's collaboration with occupying Nazis during World War II. Among the monarchist fascist groups shaped during this swirl of political commotion was Alpha Galactis, the First Gauls. Now, the organization generated little interest and made even less impact till its members elected at its head a teenager named Pierre Plantard. Either very precocious as well-connected, Plantard achieved fame and notoriety exceeding both his working-class origins and his mediocre intellect. He sometimes assumed the cliched manner and appearance of French underworld characters, gaunt and dark, with a perpetual sneer and a galosse hanging from his lips. At other times, he posed as an intellectual, an existentialist comfortable in the company of a Moreau or Sartre. The best depiction of Plantard, who identified himself variously as Pierre de France and Plantard de la St. Clair, is chameleon-like. He altered whatever aspect of his life and values necessary to achieve whatever goal happened to fall within his vision at the time. Other descriptions of the man are less neutral, including charlatan, fraud artist, and convicted criminal. And you confirm the last one via the French police archives, revealing he'd been found guilty of extortion and embezzlement and sentenced to 6 months in prison. Well, during the Vichy regime that ruled Nazi-occupied France from 1940 to 44, Plantard and his Alpha Galactis group published Vaincre, to Conquer, a magazine dedicated to French nationalism and restoration of the monarchy. Many of the publication's articles are openly anti-Semitic and anti-Masonic, an accusation that Plantard later justified by claiming it avoided censure by the Gestapo. Well, if that were indeed the strategy, it didn't work. It was shut down and Plantard imprisoned in 43 because, according to Nazi records, he was too openly supportive of French fascist views over those of Germany. Plantard, in later years, had a more flattering explanation. The Nazis discovered his articles in the magazine contained secret codes for French resistance fighters. Now, whichever side Plantard might have been on, he was clearly a firebrand when it came to French nationalism, a role he pursued well and with great vigor after hostilities ended in 1945. In 1947, he created the Latin Academy, whose avowed purpose was to conduct historical research, but whose more apparent goal was to continue the right-wing activities of Alpha Galactis. As a mark of the group's questionable success, documents incorporating the Academy listed Plantard's mother as its titular head. Well, he became a familiar figure among certain Catholic leaders in Paris, particularly the Seminary of Saint-Sulpice. And it was there in the mid-50s began claiming to be the Merovingian pretender to the French throne. Later in 1956, he extended that identity by proclaiming himself leader of a divinely guided organization founded by Godfrey de Bouillon during the time of the Crusades and whose members had been influencing world events since the days of Christ. This organization was called the Priory de Sion. Well, the organization's title may have changed, borrowed from the medieval monastery that began as Our Lady of Mount Zion, but in most ways it remained Alpha Galactis attached to a new face in a new magazine, this one called Circuit. Plantard's publication soon began carrying stories of Father Saunier hinting at secrets the priests uncovered in a remote Pyrenees village. The articles eventually formed the basis of a book by Plantard detailing Saunier's discoveries, implications that Christ's body had been buried near the little church dedicated to Mary Magdalene. The uniting of Christ's descendants and French Gothic blood with the marriage of Dagobert and Giselle and the astounding secret that had been maintained through the lives of great men of history. I mean, frankly, it was an intriguing story, but Plantard's writing style was less than gripping because nobody appeared interested in publishing his book. In an effort to generate support for his literary work, Plantard announced he'd obtained two of the parchments discovered by Saunier in the hollow pillar supporting the altar, and with some fanfare he bestowed them on the Bibliothèque Nationale, the French National Library. Now, the existence of these parchments represent a vital link between Saunier's strange behavior and the existence of the Priory de Sion. Suddenly, there were a few believers where only skeptics had stood smiling and shaking their heads before. Both parchments provided by Plantard contained hidden messages, one honoring Dagobert's marriage to Giselle and the other more cryptic, referring to the Priory de Sion. Once their contents, if not their authenticity, were confirmed, Plantard stunned scholars and historians by announcing the documents proved he was a direct descendant of Dagobert and Giselle, thus explaining his role as Grand Master of the Priory de Sion. The parchments were followed by a revised version of the book, now made publishable thanks to the parchments and some serious rewriting by co-author Gerard de Sade. Titled L'Or La Lorraine's and published in 1967, the book detailed the story of the Priory's beginnings with Mary Magdalene and Christ's children, accompanied either by Christ or his corpse, escaping across the Mediterranean to Gaul. And from there, it traced his bloodline through Giselle de Rosé's, tracked her descendants across 1,300 years of world history, and ended with the discovery of the parchments and other paraphernalia by Saunier. The book's revelations generated two distinct and equally fervent points of view. One found the story indisputable, relying on various sources for its authenticity, including the mysterious wealth accumulated by Saunier, the existence of the parchments, historical references to Dagobert and the Merovingian line, and Plantard's own convincing accounts. The imagination of these believers galloped toward conviction that a secret society had carried one of mankind's greatest mysteries through generations of descendants, whose intellectual superiority and creativity could be explained through a direct connection with the Creator. These adherents scurried to locate historical references that supported Plantard's claims, and inevitably they found some. And with each apparent confirmation, momentum grew among the believers. The other side remained skeptical, and over time they discovered a few realities of their own. The first speed bump on the Priory Road occurred when two of Plantard's associates, Gerard de Sade and Philippe de Cherisse, sued Plantard to recover royalties promised him from the book's sale. De Sade's role as co-author was acknowledged, but who was de Cherisse? He was revealed as a well-educated academic with a reputation as something of a prankster. By the time L'Or de Rennes was published, he had acquired a drinking habit that would eventually kill him. More importantly, de Cherisse claimed that the parchments submitted to the Bibliothèque Nationale were forgeries. He knew they were, he said, because he had produced them as a means of generating publicity and authenticity from Plantard's book. But Plantard, by now riding a wave of publicity and sales from L'Or de Rennes, quickly agreed with de Cherisse. The parchments weren't authentic, he admitted, but they were not forgeries either. They were meticulous copies of the original parchments, which, due to their value, Plantard was storing at a safe place whose location he refused to reveal. He also announced his family had suppressed the fact that their origins were not entirely French. He said his ancestors included a distinct lineage with the St. Clairs, Angelicized as Sinclair, who had founded Scottish Rite Freemasonry. And this alleged link explained the means of maintaining the secrecy of the Priory de Sion's existence down through the centuries. Now, this revelation satisfied the believers, but prompted skeptics to dig even deeper into the tale with some remarkable results. The first discovery involved a close examination of the pillars that had supported the altar in Saunier's church, easily located in René La Chateau, where they were displayed as part of the town's heritage. None of the pillars examined were hollow. In fact, all three were quite solid, with the exception of a crack in one that may have concealed a postcard or two, but nothing more. And an even more disturbing revelation was to follow. Remember the name Noel Corbeau? He purchased Villa Bethania, the mansion Saunier had built with the money earned from his supposed discovery of either bones or treasure. Following Saunier's death, Marie Denernaud converted the mansion into a rooming house before exchanging it for the lifetime annuity from Corbeau. Well, after Marie died in 1953, Corbeau transformed Villa Bethania into a small hotel and restaurant. Well, with nothing to attract tourists to René La Chateau beyond tales of Saunier's eccentricities and his mysterious wealth, Corbeau's investment in his operation would clearly never amount to much. Well, he solved the problem with nothing less than a marketing tool, a device that owed everything to entrepreneurial strategy and almost nothing to the truth. Well, he concocted a dramatic tale of the legend behind Saunier's mysterious accumulation of wealth, populated with characters who would be quite at home in a Harry Potter novel and delivered with the flair of a campfire ghost story. Recording the narrative in his own voice, he played it at his restaurant as a diversion for diners, later publishing it in a pamphlet formed as a souvenir of their visit. Now, the story of Saunier and René La Chateau was hardly Joseph Conrad quality, but it did amuse visitors dining on their Paulo Pol and Cassolet. They absorb facts about the town's Roman and Gothic roots, its destruction during the various battles with Spain, the arrival of Berenger Sonia in 1885, his poverty-stricken early years, and his sudden, unexplained accumulation of wealth. To this point, Corbeau, who had never denied being the author, remained reasonably close to confirmable facts. He began to explain the source of Saunier's fortune, though. Fiction trampled fact into obscurity. According to Corbeau, files in Carcassonneau confirmed that Saunier had stumbled upon a fortune buried beneath his church in 1249 by Blanche de Castile, mother of Louis IX, the last great crusader and the only French king declared to be a saint. A mini-revolt led by power-seeking barons and oppressed vassals began soon after the king departed for Palestine. His mother, sensing Paris wasn't the safest place for the royal treasury, secretly shipped the monarch's gold and jewels to René La Chateau. Well, when Louis returned from the east, he subdued the revolt and left Paris again several years later, this time to lead the Eighth Crusade. He never returned from this trip, dying in Tunis and leaving his son Philippe Lohardet as his successor. Philippe decided the country's treasure was safer in this remote village than in the capital and improved the town's defenses. But apparently he forgot to tell his son, Philippe Le Bel, destroyer of the Templars, about the country's mobile riches because from that point forward, according to Corbeau, the treasure was forgotten. Well, how does even a French king from the Middle Ages forget 180 tons of gold plus jewels and art objects worth, according to Corbeau's 1956 estimate, 4,000 billion francs? And even more basic, how did the French king's servants transport 180 plus tons of gold and other goodies more than 650 kilometers in the first place? And why, of all places, to René La Chateau, one of the furthest locations from Paris on the border with one of France's enemies? Well, nobody had the answer to that, distracted perhaps by Corbeau's next revelation. According to him, the treasure was found twice. 1645, a shepherd named Ignace Paris fell in a hole and brought back gold and coins. He claimed he saw a room filled with gold, finally went mad trying to protect his treasure. The owner of the castle searched for it but couldn't find it. Later came Saunier, who did find it. It's in this small village with a superb landscape and a prestigious history that one of the most fabulous treasures in the world is still hidden to this day. There's no way Saunier could have spent all the money that was allegedly buried there. This kind of fable is probably more effective than a rave review in Paris Match as drawing patrons to Corbeau's hotel and restaurant. And Corbeau knew it and took advantage of contacts in the media to spread his tale among newspapers and magazines. Well, René La Chateau didn't become a new Monaco overnight, but it did seem to draw its share of intrigued visitors, and among them was Pierre Plantard, maybe in search of another scam. The meeting between Corbeau and Plantard is not speculation. Photographs confirm the two met around 1960, shortly before Plantard wrote his first draft of the book, eventually published as L'Or de René. Well, the most notable absence in Corbeau's fable was any mention of the lovely Gisèle, whose marriage to Dagobert joined the power of the Visigoths with the bloodline of Christ. So how could Corbeau overlook such a vital episode as the historical legend? The answer is very simple. Gisèle de Rosay's never existed. She's as fictional as Snow White. She didn't exist, neither flesh or spirit, in the 7th century, and exists in the 21st century only in the minds of deluded followers, conspiracy buffs, and gullible readers of recent best-selling novels. Despite claimed records tracing a family lineage before and after Gisèle, in the opinion of Avad Kleinberg, noted medieval scholar, professor of history at Tel Aviv University, the beautiful, intelligent, and charming Gisèle remains an invention of the 20th century. Well, without the existence of Gisèle, Plantard's entire fabrication collapsed beneath him like a papal port, so he simply created her as a Visigoth connection with the Merovingian bloodline. Plantard admitted as much from time to time. Consistency was not one of his most notable virtues and launched a new version of the Priory Tale in 1989. At that time, he claimed a man named Roger Patrice Pilat, an acquaintance of then-Prime Minister Mitterrand, was the current Priory Grand Master of the Priory de Sion and not Plantard himself, as he'd been claiming for 30 years. P. Feel that status was never confirmed, but at least had a thing in connection with Plantard. Both have been convicted of fraud and embezzlement. Plantard's trial taking place soon after his apparent elevation to Grand Master status. In September 1993, during an official investigation into Prelat's activities, Plantard, who never encountered a media moment he didn't like, came forward in his friend's defense. It was a move he regretted after the presiding judge ordered a search at Plantard's dwelling. Search uncovered reams of documents, some that stated Plantard was king of France, which was enough for the judge to order Plantard to answer questions under oath. And whatever inquisition techniques might have been used, Plantard quickly admitted the entire undertaking was a hoax. He'd made up all the details regarding the bloodline, including the marriage of Giselle and Dagobert, the discovery by Saunier of either a treasure or a quartz beneath or near his church, his own identity as a prior designed Grand Master. Well, the judge, maybe being lenient because of Plantard's age and broken spirit, called Plantard a harmless crank, released him with a warning not to play games with the French judicial system. Well, Plantard walked out of the courtroom and into obscurity until he died in February 2000. Well, these events, the investigation of Prelat, the claims of Plantard about Prelat's grandmaster status and the priory design, the phony documents, Plantard's admission of fraud, which was were widely reported in the French media at the time, and nobody's disputed them. They're as authentic and confirmable as the fable of Giselle is imaginary. Of course, there is just enough truth to the story of Saunier and his supposed holy bloodline to suggest that Plantard lied not when he told his often altered table when he claimed the priory was a fabrication. There is evidence his original tale might be true after all. Maybe his claim under oath had all been a fabrication was one man's effort to conceal the sacred truth. I mean, how could this somewhat simple-minded man create such a complex structure as the Merovingian bloodline supported by documents from the past? Well, the answer to that lies in the maelstrom of political upheaval that swept up Europe during the 20s and 30s when Plantard was first building his reputation as an imaginative syncopate of fascist principles. During these years, an Italian fanatic named Julius Evola attracted the attention of far-right proponents, including Heinrich Himmler and Oswald Mosley, when he published an Italian version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That was supposed to be a book that claimed that Jewish leaders had met the 19th century to frame their strategy for ruling the world. Evola supported a philosophy similar to the divine right of kings, promoting the old system of power based on acceptance of a true monarch as a sacred being from whom divine virtues and powers flow to his subjects. And he especially admired Godfrey de Bouillon, the first European ruler of Palestine and supposedly the founder of the Priory de Sion. Well, about that same time, a German scholar named Walter Johannes Stein published in 9th Century World History in the Light of the Holy Grail, a doctoral dissertation that included a genealogical chart Stein labeled the Grail Bloodline. And although the bloodline was a symbolic representation of historical figures who had demonstrated a high spiritual nature and paranormal capabilities, somebody skimming the surface of Stein's premise could easily mistake the symbols for real people, especially when Stein's lineage chart included Godfrey de Bouillon and the French royal family. Now, these and other esoteric documents accessible in libraries across France could easily have stimulated Plantard's imagination. Spiced with his confirmed penchant for fraud and his hunger for public recognition, Plantard shaped a core of history with a cover of esoterica wrapped around a substantial amount of fiction into a ball of a fairy tale that he rolled down a mountain, the ball growing in weight and stature until it swept up three British writers who molded it into a bestseller titled The Holy Blood and Holy Grail. But that does leave one very important mystery unanswered. Where did Father Saunier find the money for his extravagant construction and lifestyle? Unlike other aspects of the tale, this was certainly no myth. Saunier's Magdalena Tower, extravagant church interior, and the Villa Bethania mansion exist to this day. How could he amass so much money without finding Louis IX's treasure or blackmailing the church with Christ's bones? The confirmed answer, many maintain, is very simple. Fraud. Until the practice was outlawed by Vatican II, Catholic priests could claim a stipend for celebrating a mass to heal an illness suffered by a living person or to hasten the passage through purgatory to heaven for a departed soul. An income from these masses was an acceptable and even encouraged form of financial support for the priest and his parish. In time, though, unscrupulous priests saw these commissioned masses as a source of substantial income from the Catholics beyond their community and even beyond their country. Soon, masses were being marketed like any mail-order item, advertised in newspapers and Catholic journals. The faithful could have a mass said on behalf of whomever they desired by sending money and details to the priest whose name appeared in the advertisement. And nobody, except God and the priest himself, could confirm that the mass actually occurred. A priest might receive literally thousands of mail requests, each accompanied by a few francs in cash, to celebrate mass in the same week or even on the same day. The practice was called trafficking in masses, and it appears that Saunier was a master of the process. Advertisements appeared in various publications throughout Europe that were traced back to the priest in the Pyrenees, and an examination of his books, recording the responses to his marketing campaign, revealed that Saunier could not possibly celebrate all the masses he'd been paid to conduct, even if he were employed at the task 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The volume of mass requests and the money enclosed over the years between 1895 and 1904 easily exceeded the 200,000 francs needed to achieve all the construction Saunier directed, as well as all the goodies such as the rum shipments from the Caribbean. Correspondence seized from Saunier's church when he was defrocked revealed the enormous extent of his industry. One family sent 250 francs to pay for 125 masses celebrated for each of their two departed sisters. One widow afforded 45 francs to pay for 30 masses for her dead soldier husband, and members of a convent paid 16 francs for masses for their recently deceased abbess, who herself had paid Saunier for several masses. Well, Saunier may have had a silent mentor for his mass marketing scheme, if you'll forgive the pun. Investigations reveal that Monsignor Billard, Bishop of Carcassonne, had been under an investigation at the time of his death for acting in a similar manner, which may explain his tolerance for Saunier's own indiscretions. Well, all these people are long dead now. Beringer Saunier, Marie Dinarneau, Pierre Plantard, Gerard de Sade, Philippe de Courcy, Norbert Corbeau, having built his Latour Hotel and restaurant into a thriving little business, thanks to the myth of the buried treasure, sold it for a pretty price in 1964 and retired. 1968, he was killed in a motor accident. The myth lives on because people want it to survive and even grow, if only to satisfy their love of deep mystery and colorful intrigue. Somebody will doubtlessly claim to see the ghost of Giselle Rosé, beautiful and radiant, strolling the grounds near the Magdalena Tower in her wedding finery, sighing for her lost Dagobert and searching for the buried treasure. But if that happens, the only thing you can count on being real is the tower itself. But I would point out that whatever he found was sufficient that he could actually blackmail the church hires. And he did that on more than one occasion. When he got defrocked, that wasn't the first time he was threatened with that. In fact, he was brought to Rome to be formally punished, and whatever he showed the Pope put an end to that. So what exactly was found, if anything? There's a number of other people besides Saunier himself who saw the parchments. There's a number of other people besides Saunier who talked about the hollow leg of the altar. So what is the truth after, 125 years? It's awful hard to know what's true and what's false. We're dealing with belief and people's faith. Now, I know the Merovingians existed. I'm descended from them. I know the French royal family existed. I'm descended from, actually, Philippe le Bel. Philip the Fair who destroyed the Templars. On the other side of the family, I'm also descended from a number of the Templars. So at a certain point in time, politics doesn't matter. It's people that matters. In fact, going back for a moment to the coronavirus, one reason it spread so rapidly in Italy is in order to be politically correct, the mayor of one Italian town held a special ceremony, Hug a Chinese Day, because he didn't want to be accused of furthering racism. And as a result of that, the coronavirus spread like wildfire. So, as I have said many, many times, one of the worst things that ever happened to this world is political correctness. And one of the main people that has pushed political correctness ever since I've known her was Hillary Clinton. Well, when you dig deeply into all the stories about the current coronavirus, there is evidence supporting the premise that it is or was created in a laboratory. And it wouldn't be the first time something like that was created and got loose. But if you will notice, the Chinese are taking great advantage of it, especially in the South China Sea. And they want to take back Taiwan. Well, if everyone's too ill to fight them, they win in a walk. And certainly that would make them a very, very powerful adversary on the world stage. Well, I do want to wish everybody a health and long life. I hope everyone is doing well. I will tell you, not leaving the house for over a month is incredibly boring, but it beats the alternative. Well, until tomorrow night at 6 p.m., this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.